Se cumplen 15 años del Plan Colombia, anunciado en el 2000 como un acuerdo para reducir la producción de narcóticos en el país suramericano. El acuerdo firmado entre el gobierno colombiano y Estados Unidos ha provocado el desplazamiento de comunidades enteras y miles de ejecuciones extrajudiciales realizadas por fuerzas paramilitares en coordinación con el ejército colombiano. Santiago Lozano, de Contagio Radio, nos ofrece los detalles.
Al cumplirse 15 años del acuerdo entre Colombia y Estados Unidos para la lucha contra el narcotráfico conocido como Plan Colombia, desde organizaciones como la Oficina de Washington para Latinoamérica, WOLA, se asegura que no puede ser glorificado por parte de su país por las consecuencias negativas que este ha traído en temas ambientales, sociales y en derechos humanos.
En nuestra opinión, es un error muy grande de parte de nuestro gobierno de Estados Unidos de glorificar el Plan Colombia, porque el Plan Colombia básicamente en su enfoque fue un plan que apoyó un esfuerzo antinarcótico y esfuerzo que no dio los resultados que debería dar. Por ejemplo, guerra antidrogas, el punto era que el Plan Colombia iba a reducir el crecimiento de coca al punto que iban a entrar menos cocaína en Estados Unidos y ayudar a parar este problema. Eso no ha sido el resultado. De hecho, ha tenido consecuencias muy negativas en términos de las fumigaciones aéreas, donde ha dañado mucho la seguridad alimentaria, dispersado la coca y creado problemas ambientales y de salud en muchas comunidades rurales.
Jimena Sánchez, vocera de la organización, afirma además que gracias a la asistencia a las fuerzas militares por parte del Plan Colombia, se cometieron violaciones graves, incluyendo sus relaciones con grupos paramilitares.
En particular, durante la administración de Álvaro Uribe Vélez, donde se violaron las violaciones de una manera atroz, una parte directamente por fuerzas armadas, miembros de Fuerzas Armadas que hicieron más de 3.000 ejecuciones extrajudiciales contra civiles, también donde se violó mucho el principio de distinción y hubo una situación muy alta de desplazamiento forzado, y además hubo acción y colaboración con que están en la lista de terrorismo para los Estados Unidos. Estados Unidos mismo tiene condicionamientos a esa ayuda militar que prohíben ese tipo de actuación, y fue debido a eso que se tuvo que reformar y cambiar mucho la actitud en términos de cómo actuaban las fuerzas militares en Colombia.
Por su parte, Claudia Erazo, directora de la Corporación Gira Castro, que trabaja con comunidades campesinas, asegura que es necesario que haya un apoyo al actual proceso de paz por parte de la comunidad internacional, pero que sea dirigido a las comunidades para que ésta sea sostenible y duradera.
Yo creo que en estos momentos en el que el país se aboca a un proceso de diálogo y negociación con las guerrillas, es aún más que necesario un apoyo de la comunidad internacional, pero un apoyo que se enfoque a la construcción de paz, un apoyo para el desarrollo económico de las regiones, un apoyo para la sostenibilidad de del proceso de paz. Eso significa apoyo para que se puedan realizar los acuerdos en materia de transformaciones sociales, económicas y políticas, que serían las que garantizarían la estabilidad de este proceso, ¿no? Está claro, y en 15 años se demostró que una cooperación exclusivamente para lo militar no logró poner fin al conflicto armado ni logró llevar desarrollo a las regiones.
A pesar de las múltiples críticas y evidencias de que el Plan Colombia no ha servido a las comunidades, el presidente Juan Manuel Santos buscará en su próxima reunión con el presidente de Estados Unidos, Barack Obama, acordar un nuevo Plan Colombia, con el que a su juicio buscará apoyo para lo que vendrá luego de la firma de los acuerdos de paz con las FARC. Para Aler Contacto Sur, informó desde Contagio Radio Andrés Santiago Lozano.
El fiscal general de El Salvador afirmó que continúa abierto el caso judicial contra el expresidente Francisco Flores, fallecido el fin de semana. Flores enfrentaba acusaciones de apropiación de 15 millones de dólares donados por Taiwán para los damnificados del terremoto ocurrido durante su mandato. Los detalles con Norma Ramírez.
En El Salvador, el fiscal general de la República, Douglas Meléndez, reiteró que efectivamente en el caso que se llevaba contra el expresidente Francisco Flores, fallecido el fin de semana pasado, prosigue la responsabilidad civil, es decir, al pago del dinero malversado por el ex presidente. El titular de esta institución salvadoreña agregó que cuando llegue a esa instancia la documentación de medicina legal que certifica la muerte del ex presidente Francisco Flores, esta será enviada al juzgado quinto de instrucción, donde se llevaba el proceso. Escuchemos lo que dijo el fiscal salvadoreño.
En este momento existen ciertos bienes embargados, una cuenta bancaria un poco más de $5,000 y, si no me equivoco, como un aproximado de 8 inmuebles. Lo que ocurre aquí es que nosotros vamos a presentar, le vamos a informar oficialmente al juez sobre la muerte, sobre el documento de medicina legal que lo certifica, y en ese momento le vamos a hacer que debe pronunciarse él sobre la acción civil, sobre la acción penal con el sobreseimiento que corresponde, y sobre la acción civil será el juez el que la va a determinar. Él tendrá que determinar la acción civil, si es que la determina, y posiblemente tendría que determinar el monto total.
Además, el fiscal Meléndez dijo que desde la institución a la que representa también se podría investigar a los destinatarios de los fondos malversados por Flores, y a los que él mismo se refirió en una comisión legislativa especial en 2014 que se estableció para investigar cuál fue el destino de los fondos donados por la República de China-Taiwán durante el periodo de Flores, que venían para ayudar a familiares y a las víctimas de quienes sufrieron los terremotos del año 2001 aquí en El Salvador. Escuchemos lo que dijo el fiscal Douglas Meléndez sobre esto.
Pues sí, vamos a tener que investigar también, ¿verdad? Yo creo que nuestro país y la población merece respuestas en estos casos, ¿verdad? Eso es lo importante, más que todo. Así es que también vamos a investigar, no podemos evitar hacerlo, ¿verdad? Pero quiero decirle, no es que se le esté cuestionando a la fiscalía, yo creo que el cuestionamiento debería ser para las anteriores administraciones.
Y sobre la muerte del ex funcionario del expresidente Francisco Flores han surgido muchas dudas. Sobre esto, la dirigente social Margarita Posada dijo.
Bueno, mire, eso es producto de la misma falta de confianza que tiene el pueblo en el sistema judicial. Si nosotros tuviéramos un sistema judicial en el que la gente confiara, nadie dudaría de que si Francisco Flores está muerto o no está muerto. O sea, porque dicen, es que vinieron de medicina legal y le hicieron una revisión, levantaron un acta de defunción. Entonces, ¿qué dice la gente? Pero medicina legal es lo mismo. O sea, ¿a qué se debe que la gente esté dudando de eso? A que no hay confianza en el sistema judicial. Entonces, ¿ustedes creen que nosotros vamos a hacer esfuerzos como país de construir la paz de manera colectiva si el pueblo no tiene confianza en el ente que es determinante, que es la administración de justicia?
La dirigente sindical agregó que es necesario que en el país haya una depuración del sistema judicial para que las investigaciones y los procesos que se lleven no queden en la impunidad. Francisco Flores fue acusado de 3 delitos, enriquecimiento ilícito, desobediencia a particulares y peculado, esto por haber malversado más de $15 millones provenientes de la cooperación taiwanesa para ayudar a familias afectadas por los terremotos del año 2001 en El Salvador, lo que coincidió con su mandato presidencial desde 1999 hasta el año 2004.
Estás escuchando el Informativo Pacífica.
Te invitamos a que te unas a nuestras redes sociales por Twitter en info-pacífica o por Facebook bajo el nombre de nuestro productor Fernando Velázquez e Informativo Pacífica. Escucha el noticiero cada día de lunes a viernes en Pueblos Sin Fronteras wordpress.com.
La que toca tiene labios sin color. El rojo se fue en la boca de un guitarrero cantor. Allá. La guitarrera que toca guarda penas bajo el chal.
En España, 200 personas acumularon el año pasado un patrimonio equivalente al 19% del Producto Interno Bruto. Eso representa un aumento del 16% con respecto al 2014, informan los compañeros de Telesur.
Además de un contexto político y social que siempre da de qué hablar, España destaca por la facilidad que tienen los más ricos para seguir acumulando sus riquezas, incluso en medio de periodos económicamente turbulentos. No es secreto que en lugar de disminuir sus acaudaladas cuentas, esta minoría de la población española suma cada vez más a su patrimonio neto. En el 2015, el balance arrojó un total de 205.609 millones de euros, 16% más que en el 2014 y 74.000 millones más que hace apenas 5 años. La cifra total equivale al 19% del Producto Interno Bruto del año pasado y permite entrever más números alarmantes. Dentro de 200 grandes fortunas, hay 40 que superan los 1.000 millones de euros. Y es que no solo se trata de personajes como el cantante Julio Iglesias o la baronesa Thyssen. De hecho, el grupo comprende en su mayoría empresarios o herederos. Por ejemplo, destaca Amancio Ortega, empresario fundador de la marca Zara, Emporio Textil, cuyo tirón permitió que en un solo año Ortega sumara a su patrimonio 16.336 millones más. Y ante esto existe otra realidad, mucho más importante, pues mientras el patrimonio de estas grandes fortunas se incrementó en 16% en el último año, la riqueza del 99% de la población española cayó un 15% en el mismo periodo. Estudios de la Agencia de Estadística Europea Eurostat afirman que España es de los países en los que más ha aumentado la desigualdad desde el inicio de la crisis, en razón de 10 veces más que el promedio europeo. Durante el 2015, el 1% más rico concentró casi tanta riqueza como el 80% más pobre, y además, la fortuna del 5% más acaudalado superó la riqueza del 90% más pobre. En resumen, actualmente existen 2,3 millones de españoles que poseen un patrimonio superior al de 42 millones de personas. ¿Qué factores ayudan a que se registre esta dura realidad? Una política laboral que no permite generación de empleo de calidad y con buenos salarios, así como un sistema fiscal que debilita el crecimiento y en el que 9 de cada 10 euros recaudados proviene del bolsillo de los trabajadores, mientras menos de un euro lo hace del rendimiento del capital. Es así como se explica el aumento de la brecha salarial entre ricos y pobres y el aumento de personas en riesgo de pobreza o exclusión social.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica, un noticiero producido diariamente con el trabajo voluntario y digno de sus colaboradores. A nombre de Toshli, del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Está sintonizando Radio Pacífica KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles, 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara. Estamos en recaudación de fondos. Su apoyo económico es muy importante. Llámenos al 818-985-5735 o pueden ver todos los obsequios que se ofrecen en la recaudación simplemente yendo a kpfk.org.
El hombre que tiene algo que decir se desespera al no encontrar oyentes, pero es más desalentador para el escucha el no encontrar a alguien que tenga algo que decirle.
Carrito contamina, gasta mucho gas y ya no da más.
No lo pienses más. Dónala a tu estación KPFK.
1-877-KPFK-AUTO. 1-877-KPFK-AUTO.
Contribuye al medio ambiente y hasta tu cartera.
This is Ward Churchill saying, get yourself a mind transplant. Listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, it's the February 4th, 2016 edition of Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides. I've just gotten out of the the hospital, and so I'm not in the best shape, but I'm going to do here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to play another flashback. I kind of like the flashbacks I've been playing in the last couple of shows. This is a flashback from February 6th, 2003, wow, 13 years ago, and I don't have much new to report on, but it does include some clips from Roxana Kistapache, who was also, if not featured, at least part of the last show. She died recently. She was a strong activist who took no shit from anybody, and particularly politicians, and she spoke about it with her daughter, Alicia, quite clearly and quite frequently at city council. Whether that did any good, of course, is another issue. But let's listen to the show, and perhaps you'll find it and enjoy it, or find it enjoyable. This was around the time when the Citizens Police Review Board was destroyed. That was at the very beginning of 2003, once the board under the chair of Mark Half Moon began to research issues like use and display of force, racial and class discrimination, selective enforcement, and failure of the police chief at that time, Steve Belcher, to simply come through on his promises to follow up on complaints. He was quite an artful dodger, and I think now he's doing artful dodging in another city as another police chief. And this was also around the time when the Iraqi war was heating up. There was a lot of anti-war protests that turned out to be largely symbolic, which is what I fear all this Bernie Sanders brouhaha is going to be, since Bernie essentially abandoned an independent course 20 years ago when he signed on to the Democratic Party. But that's the period of time we're looking at. Also, it was a time when the downtown ordinances got a special merchant-pleasing makeover from Emily Riley, Mike Rotkin, Cynthia Matthews, and the current city council. So listen up and see if you get anything out of this. If you want to call me, call 423-4833. Maybe a little while before I get back to you because I'm pooped. I have to do a lot of recovery stuff, but I'm working on it. So here we go.
Politicians have lying eyes, the sure as suffering multiplies, the rich will never be poor. As certain as in life you learn, the rich have money and time to burn, the rich will counsel you, waste your turn in heaven, you'll get some more. As sure as poverty plagues the land, the rich will give you a helping hand, as soon as mountains return to sand and oceans leave the shore. Count on nothing in life so well, that if the rich go straight to hell, lots are something they buy and sell, they'll never enter the door. Clearly all that you need in life to be at peace in a world of strife, the company of a man or wife and lots of money in store. Life is simple and so complete, with faithful friends and some bread to eat, a solid roof and a room with heat and socks and bonds galore. The rich will probably tell you nay, it's inner riches that really pay. The rich have always got lots to say as they watch their assets soar. Count on nothing in life so plain, the poor have water, the rich champagne. The market rises to this refrain, the rich will never be poor, the rich will never be poor. As sure as life is a strange affair, in need of some robust repair, the rich don't actually have to care, the rich will never be poor. Maybe people are all the same, but the rich are playing a different game. You take your chances and take your aim, you'll never even the score. The rich can't help it if life's unfair, the richer people, they really care. They often mention it's hard to bear their burden at their core. Some say no, but it's plain to see, the rich are different than you and me. The rich are different as they can be, the rich will
will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor. The rich will never be poor.
And that's The Rich Will Never Be Poor, from an album of the same name by Carol Denny. Carol has also written a piece for the Berkeley Daily Planet, which is an online publication, berkeleydailyplanet.com, which is in the same website as her own Pepper Spray Times, and the February issue of that has come out too. Berkeley is a city that supposedly banned pepper spray, or did for a time. I'm not entirely clear on its current status. Pepper spray is a device used by police to disperse protesters. Carol Denny writes, "Shh, it's an official emergency. The Berkeley City Council officially affirmed that Berkeley has a shelter crisis the quietest way possible at its Tuesday, January 19th, 2016 council meeting. Councilmember Lori Capitelli requested that declare a homeless shelter crisis in Berkeley an action calendar item be added to the consent calendar instead, a place where non-controversial items can be grouped together for quick passage without the need for changes or discussion. There were no objections. Any city representative could have removed it. The item had come from District 7 Chris Worthington's office and had been booted from meeting to meeting since before the holidays. Worthington is one of the few on the Berkeley City Council who has consistently responded to the need for low-income housing and resisted the criminalization of poverty in the many years he has represented District 7, the area on the south side of the UC campus. Perhaps the critical mass of people shivering in doorways, behind dumpsters, under freeway overpasses, and in parks has finally stuffed a sock in the "We Do Enough for the Homeless" song Mayor Tom Bates usually sings in the face of any suggestion that Berkeley should do more. Most of the Berkeley City Council loves that song, a song sung by other city officials which flutter their fans over the common refrain that doing anything more should wait until there is a regional approach to housing, federal or state funding, etc. This, of course, will sound quite familiar to those people who go through the grim ritual of checking in on the Santa Cruz City Council. It's got to be regional refrain that Rochelle Noroyan yowls out or moans out or essentially repeats every time these issues come up, not to mention Cynthia Matthews, not to mention David Terrazas or Pamela Comstock. And I think Lane, in spite of all his comments about the need for compassion and his supposed upcoming sleeping ban modifications, or even elimination, has not really focused on the need for Santa Cruz to get very specific about its needs and its requirements. Santa Cruz declared shelter crises many years ago. 1990, 1995, 1998 are the times I most recently remember, though they've probably been more recent ones. These shelter crises, however, were symbolic rather than having any substantial impact. And, of course, this winter we've had no warming center buildings opened, although they said they will open one under a number of circumstances if a number of things happen. Let's hear some more of what Carol Denny says about Berkeley and understand that this is a deformity of politicians in all kinds of cities who are essentially elected and paid to cater to the wealthy. Or as Carol Denny sings, the rich will never be poor. It tempts the creative among us to draw a comic of a scruffy guy shivering on the street corner holding a sign that says, "Waiting for a regional approach to homelessness. Please help." It might be considered hypocritical for a council majority, which spent the summer hammering its way relentlessly towards another anti-homeless law, fondly known as the two-square-foot law, which says homeless people could only keep their stuff inside a two-square-foot space, to even acknowledge a homeless shelter crisis in light of decades of bluster about having enough services and just waiting patiently for that regional approach thing. But don't stop watching. If you're paying enough attention to read this far, emergency declarations can be useful. They can free up otherwise occupied funding or dissolve restricted zoning, which might otherwise complicate the use of empty buildings for shelters, of which Berkeley has plenty. But emergency declarations can also be abused. People can be forced off the streets, as happens all over the country, whether it is officially recognized or not. When New York Governor Mario Cuomo issued an executive order to force the homeless off the streets in cold weather, New York Mayor de Blasio sniffed that the city already had the ability to forcibly remove homeless New Yorkers who are in imminent danger, an observation affirmed by Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, who stated flatly that the transit police had been doing it since the early 1990s. Berkeley does it too. If the Berkeley police want you off the streets, you're gone. Maybe to John George for a psych evaluation, maybe for a 3-day stay in Berkeley's own city facility, maybe down to North County, or maybe off to Santa Rita. An enormous amount of public money, not to mention police and emergency medical staff overtime, is spent fulfilling the Downtown Berkeley Association's dream of having the streets cleared of anybody too scruffy or with too few belongings to fit into their Disneyland dreamscape. And, of course, this is just almost identically true in Santa Cruz, where you have these pseudo-programs, the DUPE program, or what they call the DAP program, these so-called homeless courts that are supposed to help homeless people, a tightening series of services with security gates, ID cards, security guards, all designed to create an impression of menace by the homeless and to add to and justify the paranoia of neighborhoods that they can't justify their gentrification processes other ways, so they use the public security card instead. You might see an abandoned shopping cart, Carol Denny continues, with a few belongings in it, some books, some socks, some useful tools or bundled belongings, and wonder about it for a few seconds, and it might mean that someone was offered a warm, cozy room in a house in exchange for keeping up the yard or helping out around the place, and left a few things behind for the next guy. But it might also mean that some impatient neighbor made a call and some city staffer or officer caught someone shipwrecked by circumstance on a really bad day. The Department of Justice way off in Washington has caught up onto the way cities spend money pointlessly circling people in need through jails and hospitals, and is tiptoeing toward insisting that housing, actual housing, be the obvious solution through its remarkable August 6, 2015 statement of interest and the Housing and Urban Development's guidelines for grants. It might seem like a moral point, but it is also a practical point. Public funding should simply not be wasted on pointless, ineffective criminalization, which often makes matters worse. Maybe the Berkeley City Council is finally listening. Maybe it finally did a little math and realized you could not only house people, you could put them through college or what we're spending on criminalizing the poor. It's a brand new year. Anything is possible. But the community of conscience, which consistently and reverently presses for the recognition that housing is a human right, knows this moment well. An emergency declaration long overdue sounds good. Let's make sure it is used in a sensible manner to help ensure that everyone has a place to call home. And this is something I really don't like about Carol's writing, and she doesn't like about my stuff. I feel that she is overly optimistic and gives a pass to these politicians. She feels that I'm overly alienating and antagonistic and remove the possibility of cooperation with these politicians. So we definitely have a difference of view. I'm now going to turn to the February 6th 2003 City Council meeting, which I will let speak for itself because I'm running out of breath. And if you have any questions or comments, call 831-423-4833. You might get an answering machine, but if you do, just leave your question and I'll hope to get back to you. Thanks for listening in.
Double chin, belly big and pill. Welcome to Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the February 6, 2003 version. In the studio with me, drinking hot chocolate and puffing like a steam engine, is Roxanne Aquistapache. Hi, Roxanne.
Hello.
Say something again.
Hello.
There we go. I can hear you on the second mic there. Sometimes we can't, and today we can, which is good. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, as we catch our breath here. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC if you happen to be listening to us at some other place than Santa Cruz. Sometimes that happens. We got people who listen to this station as far away as Germany. Germany, call in. We want to know how are you going to stop this Bush-initiated war? Let's get some troops from over there to peace troops. What am I saying? Troops. Peace monitors. Actually, we've heard there's a whole caravan going down to Baghdad to serve as human shields, and that's it's a pretty daring approach. But this program, though, we are going to be touching on the war of aggression being planned by on the edge of going forward by the Bush administration. We're more interested, or I am on this show, in the local aspects, whether it be citizens' police oversight or the oversight of, instead of not having citizens' police review that's real, or whether it be the laws that criminalize poor people like the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, whether it be institutions like Child Protective Services that have frequently abused their charter, or the public defenders and the district attorney's office, which seem to collude in a system that puts hundreds if not thousands of people in jail each year for victimless drug crimes, so-called drug crimes, all of which has a disproportionate impact on poor and homeless people, since they're usually the first in line in these kinds of operations, the first target, the most vulnerable group of people. What have I got today? Well, I've also got a guest trying to make his way to the studio who has been, he was actually jailed on the orders of the city manager for a month in November because he was trying to get his vehicle back, and he entered City Hall with a tomahawk in his belt. Apparently that was grounds enough for the police to take him down, put him in jail, and also they're seeking an injunction against his coming back. We're going to be hearing from this lunatic soon. You can judge for yourself how wise our wise city mothers and fathers have been in this case. I also have a few kind of brief notes for you about the upcoming city council meeting, usually the second and fourth Tuesdays of every month, and apparently this month is no exception. It's February, 11th or 12th? It's Tuesday, whatever day that is. And I got the word from Emily Riley, our mayor, Smiley Riley, as I call her, on some of the questions I asked her. She actually was prompt in returning my phone call and fairly responsive in her answers to my questions. For the first time, get this, folks, she will allow Huff 5 minutes to speak at the Citizens Police Review Board burial that will be coming up on Tuesday. And I'll be using the 5 minutes to discuss how it actually was Huff and other homeless groups that started the pressure to establish a Citizens Police oversight in the first place, which was then crippled by council members like Kennedy, Rotkin, and Matthews, and are now, of course, being buried and dismembered. Their funding is going to different departments. Some of the money is going to out-of-town city attorney, Palo Alto police review expert, you might say, Bob Aronson. It had been the case that Riley had been ignoring the tradition at city council, which to me actually had really more of the force of almost the force of law, which said at public hearings, that's the second hearing of any law, where the second reading of the law makes a new law officially, individuals get 3 minutes and organizations get 5. And Riley has been pointedly ignoring this around issues like the downtown ordinances, both hearings in December and January, and in the first hearing of the slicing away of the Citizens Police Review Board. And she finally acknowledged to me that, well, gosh, maybe this isn't, she kind of changed her mind and decided she would give, I assume not just me, but other organizations, since I don't think she has any special love for Huff, 5 minutes. Whether it makes any difference, of course, in terms of whether the council's going to pay any attention, I'm pretty sure it won't. But it will make a difference in terms of our right to reclaim public speaking time. Roxanne, you have spoken to city council on different occasions. Is it worth talking to the city council for 5 minutes?
I think the only reason that it's worth talking to city council is that the meeting is broadcast. And so I'm a veteran yard saler, and everywhere I go, people say to me, wow, they observe the rudeness, the cutting off of people. And so it kind of gets out. The city council listens to nothing, but the public listens to everything. If they turn that on at home, then they're pretty shocked at the way city council meetings are run. So that's good in itself.
Yeah, I know that you and your daughter, Alicia, who were originally supporters of Christopher Crone when he first came into office, I think you actually worked on his campaign at some point, or is that accurate?
We actually worked on the infamous Threes campaign.
The Tres Amigos?
Gave up many hours of sleep and lived to regret it.
And then when you came to city council, I think Alicia, your daughter, had some rather harsh words for Chris Crone.
She had harsh words for them all, actually. we were dealing with a homeless issue at the time, and Chris, I believe, was the head of a task force. So the words went to him, but it was for all of the people that we supported under false pretenses.
Well, it looks like we have an incoming call.
A caller.
It could be. Hi there. You're on Free Radio. Hello?
Yeah, hello. Is this Bob?
It is. Can you speak up?
Yeah, hi, Bob. This is
Who?
Tommy.
Who?
Tommy Martin.
Having a lot of trouble hearing you. Talk as loud as you can.
Okay. Yeah, hi. My name is Tommy.
Tom?
Yeah, I'm hearing feedback in your back of the radio station there.
Feedback?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you're hearing it on the air as you tune in?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Anyways, we're looking for a drummer.
I'm sorry?
We're looking for a drummer.
Oh, you're looking for a drummer?
Yeah, and the band's name is 20 Grit.
How would we be able to help you here?
Okay, I'll give you a telephone number.
You know, if you want to do that, you should probably contact the voicemail line.
Okay.
And then just leave that information on the voicemail.
Okay.
It's 427-4523.
4523.
Yeah.
Also, there's a song called Beyond Disorder I sent to you guys.
Uh-huh. Put that on the voicemail, too.
Okay.
Because I can't really help you with that. I don't really cover that aspect of the programming.
Oh, you don't?
No. But somebody will pick that your message up off the voicemail and presumably return a call to you.
Okay, I will.
And make you a star.
There you go. Good luck, Tom.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Superstar.
There you go. Whoa.
Well, we're going to kind of roll into the main part of the show here, except, unfortunately, I have another guest running around, probably not knowing where the studio is, as he shouldn't, because we are in a top-secret location. But until that moment comes up, that is, until I can find him and drag him over to the studio, I'm going to run out of the studio for a moment to do that. Roxanne, I can either leave you to do a brief monologue here, or I can put on a little bit of tape. Which would you prefer?
Well, to talk, of course.
Well, all right, Roxanne. I can't really show you how to handle the switchboard, but you can, in fact, give the city a sense of what you feel the important issues are that the city council is ignoring, or what you've noticed about the council that's been doing that has attracted your notice.
Why don't we start talking about the CPRB, and by the time you get here, the lines will be all warmed up.
That could be, but if we do, I won't know what you've said, and I won't be able to intelligently
address
it.
You know what I think.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you begin speaking? In fact, we may have found our man. I think I hear the tread of, could it be FCC footsteps on the stairs? We've got our man. I'm sorry, Roxanne, you're not going to be able to monopolize that mic. Let's talk about the Citizens Police Review Board, the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, the ex-Citizens Police Review Board, as it really is properly known now. On January 21st, the City Council defunded it. On January 27th, they declared its doors should be shut on the 29th, and essentially rescinded the entire CPRB law and turned all the functions over to a auditor, the aforementioned Bob Aronson of Palo Alto. I just realized, with the assistance of analyst Becky Johnson when I talked to her today, that the move by the City Council to close the doors of the Citizens Police Review Board on January 29th actually is probably an illegal action, because the law that authorizes them to be there is not removed until the second reading. And indeed, if some of you were listening to radio station KSCO yesterday, former Mayor Chris Crone, who we're just talking about, who now does a weekly talk show on KSCO, was urging people to come to next Tuesday's City Council meeting and fight to keep the CPRB. So at the present time, it is currently the law that the CPRB should be, in fact, operating. And for the city to, A, defund it, I suppose it can do that theoretically, but to close its doors sounds to me like a violation of the law. If we had a good attorney, we might be able to do something about that. Of course, it's really, there's a brief interval here. I mean, once the law is removed by City Council, which will almost assuredly be removed next Tuesday, within a month that's going to happen. And that means that what happens on Tuesday after they vote the second reading of the law killing the law, a month later, that the law gets rescinded. But throughout this period of time, the CPRB should be functional. And it's interesting that it's not. Now, no doubt our city attorney has a very interesting explanation for all this, and I probably should try to get it from him, but maybe we can elicit it at the next meeting. Is all this kind of technically irrelevant? What do you think, Roxanne?
I don't know about it being irrelevant, if it's in fact so that it's against the law, but I think the more important aspect is, why would they choose the CPRB? And my idea about City Council is that they have two functions. One is to be a front man, a pimp for redevelopment, and the second is to be a pimp for the local police. So those are their two main functions. They call it being supportive of the police, but you know, no one wants them looking in on things. And they really didn't have very much trouble with this CPRB. In fact, it was a pretty lame CPRB. But when it comes to cutting funds and doing things, what you really want is to get anybody who's on your back off your back. So they got the CPRB. They're going to let them go. I think that's really the whole point. They never did want him looking in on the police. The rules were handicapped them. The fact that they were appointed and were supposed to be yes men anyway, whether they like it or not, that's what they were supposed to be. You know, all of that, but why not just do without it? I'm sure that it'd be much easier on the police.
What about, from your perspective, I know you were listening to Chair Mark Halfmoon of the ex-CPRB, or as he is on one occasion at least called it, the CPRB in exile. I'd like, if you have to see them, hold a meeting, but I'm always hopeful that maybe that something will come out of this. What was your impression of Mark Halfmoon and of the CPRB, which actually began, some of the CPRB members, Mark and then Vice Chair Brent Faust, and I guess Hillary Hamm, the newest member of the CPRB, a UCSC student, were quite outraged that the city council had cut the board off, first cut its funding again, without notifying board members, without taking a real staff report from them, without looking at all real alternatives, without giving them option to come to their committee meetings where these things were decided. And that was another thing I heard from Mayor Riley today. She told me that between the meeting of the city council where they decided to cut the funding and the next meeting, which was the last one they had, which was to simply eliminate the board completely on January 29th and eliminate the law, they didn't actually hold an ad hoc advisory, financial advisory committee meeting as they seemed to, because there was a long four-part report from this ad hoc committee which recommended all those four things. It recommended the four things. It recommended...
Well, wouldn't that have taken some time?
Well, it would have taken, and they would have had to do it within a week period, you know, a week's period.
But wouldn't that have entailed some effort?
Well, what they did was, according to Emily Riley, they talked to Dick Wilson, the city manager.
Oh, dicked with Dick.
And they talked to Dick, and they asked him, you know, they said, you present a report, and we'll sign off on it. And that's apparently what they did. Dick presented this four-part death certificate for the police review board, and Emily Riley, Vice Mayor Scott Kennedy, and I guess it was Tim Fitzmaurice all signed off on it, and then it went right through city council with essentially nothing changed.
Well, that's the way Dick likes things.
Well, if Dick likes it that way, then
you
perhaps...
You know, I mean, yeah. Doesn't he run city council, the city manager?
He has been the city manager and the highest paid city official for the last 23 years, or 19 years, I believe it is.
Well, I'm glad city council's making someone happy. I'm glad to see it.
Well, I mean, there are those who've suggested that some of the high-flying salaries of some of these big officials should be cut. But I always say, you know, if you get the real people running the city, deserve a fancy salary, don't you think?
You mean the
police chief,
mastermind,
Cecil Cirillo, the board of the redevelopment agency. I guess it was Jim Lang had a part.
Well, you know, we could always start by just cutting out the redevelopment agency. They're certainly not needed. The earthquake is long past, and just think of all the funds that would free up right there. A lot of funds.
Indeed.
You know, we're facing school closures here. We have a redevelopment agency that's taking 15% of all of the school revenues from property taxes that the schools used to get. By 2015, they'll be taking 65%.
Really?
How come we don't see the teachers' union talking against redevelopment? Everybody's in bed with each other, and the public is the one that's going to suffer.
Hmm. So everybody's fucking, but the public gets fucked over? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and it's just not fun.
Well, that's, I guess, the reason why we wanted to talk about this issue on the air today. And if anybody out there has any thoughts on that, you can join Roxana Kistapache and myself. I'm Robert Norris here on Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Roxana, you have something you want to say?
Well, there's two things. The reason I came tonight to talk about the CPRB is there's two things that really concern me. One was the caller, Mark Halfmoon, that was telling us the thousand reasons why they couldn't get anything done. You know, I was out of town, it wasn't the right week, it should have been on the agenda, but it wasn't. They screwed us over, I have to play by the rules. And I'm hoping that from listening to this, people have learned that Robert is right. You do not play by the rules. You put your money where your mouth is. If you really want to make change, and you make it very uncomfortable for people. You kiss Fanny to get in, to get the position, and then you nuke them. Because this has been a three-year waste of time, as far as I'm concerned. Now they're out of a job. They're whining about being a CPRB in exile. They should have bypassed the government completely anyway. I don't know what rules they had to play by where they couldn't ask weekly for the results of investigations, where they couldn't give press releases saying we're still waiting for that. We have no word on that. The investigation has been going on for 9 months. We still have no word on that. And doing something that would push the police into moving, push the public into calling them and saying, hey, what's going on? But they did nothing. And so now we're at a catch-22. We're without a CPRB that didn't work anyway. But we know we really need a CPRB. I think that we should have bypassed government and should bypass government anytime we can so that we can definitely call for accountability in a not very nice way, if need be.
In fact, Roxanne, you're referring to a conversation that you didn't actually have it directly with Chair Mark Halfmoon, but he called in after you called in on Sunday, and as I was, again, we were talking about the subject of the Citizens Police Review Board, and you kind of called him on some of these issues, saying that you've been the chair. He has been the chair for 6 months. He's been on the board for a year, and for example, throughout that period of time, he didn't call for one single public hearing. Now,
which was allowed.
Yeah, public hearings were allowed, although...
I mean, they didn't even do what was allowed.
Right. I mean, Kennedy made that point in his rather disingenuous comments in today's City on a Hill Press. If you take a look at the City on a Hill, you'll see a rather garbled story by Amity Bacon. Unfortunately, it's a lot of mistakes in it. But one of the things she does is she quotes Vice Mayor Scott Kennedy, who does say... somewhat accurately that they didn't use the powers they had by calling for public hearings. What he doesn't say is that he would have raised a stink if they had started to ask for public hearings on a regular basis. On one occasion, in one case, at one moment, he did suggest it might be a good idea for a public hearing in the Happy John Dine case. But he never brought that up as a resolution in City Council. He never pursued it. He allowed the board under then-chair dentist Bill Christie to essentially completely rubber stamp the Art Danner, Steve Belcher, Belcher's our police chief, Danner was then our DA, cover-up of the Happy John Dine shooting. And he's done nothing since then. And Kennedy, you know, therefore I don't put a lot of stock in his commentary. He also helped to produce a very weak board at the beginning. He proposed a board in order to sideline the Baker investigation in 1992, when then-officer Butchie Baker was accused of sexually harassing 8 or 9 women who came forward. And a city council, and after great public pressure, created a subcommittee of the city council and of the women's commission to look into it. And in order to kill this commission, Dick Wilson, then Don Lane, who was mayor, and Scott Kennedy put together this, oh, we're going to have a police review board. And then they delayed the police review board for 2 years, and when it did come out, it was stripped of any mandatory public hearing powers and independent-funded investigatory powers, as well as various other strong aspects that would have made it a real oversight body. And as a consequence, the people who originally initiated this and supported the process of the Citizens Police Review Board, people like Attorney Margaret Marr, activist Sherry Connable, various other attorneys, John Malkin, essentially gave up on the board very quickly, although Malkin was on the board for a year before the police department, in the person of Sergeant Clark, drove him off the board by essentially saying he had political files and threatening Malkin, and then the board's not supporting him, and Malkin seeing that he wasn't going to get anywhere with a board that essentially was interested in endorsing what the police department did and engaging in kind of quiet diplomacy behind the scenes instead of, as you suggest, Roxanne, regular press releases, regular press conferences, public demands that the police department...
That's what you suggested,
follow
Robert.
...the law. Well, I think that you just suggested...
He likes to put words in my mouth.
Well, say no more. What do you say out there, members of the public? Who did suggest it first?
Let's get in. Whose idea was this?
In any case, is it your idea? Is it a good idea? What do we do now that there is no board and that we even seem to be having trouble getting the CPRB to... some of the CPRB members and some of the supporters to get together and hold a... Mark Halfmoon called it a CPRB in exile. That would be a good idea. There's been some rumor that, and I've heard this secondhand said, although I haven't received a call back from Mark myself, that there's a meeting coming up this Sunday where there will be kind of a proposed CPRB in exile, but it does require some leadership. I mean, I think it would be an excellent idea to have a People's Tribunal meeting, in essence, call it a CPRB in exile, call it what you want. And you got something you want to say there, Roxanne?
Yeah, shut up, Robert.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, the things we have to say. Go ahead.
No, there's only one thing that Robert and I talked to the CPRB a couple of years ago about bypassing government and about being independent. And it was said to us that they could not do that because unless they were a legal entity, the police would not turn over the results of investigations and the paperwork necessary to get on with it. But what everyone's found is they don't do that anyway. They stall. They just don't do it. There's no accountability. They don't have to tell you where they are in an investigation, how long the investigation's going to take. I mean, it could be over and you wouldn't know it. So there was a very interesting program right here on Radio Free Santa Cruz about ethyl alcohol and producing your own. And the man that was speaking said that in all cases we should bypass government, that the less we need them, the more we can do for ourselves, the less value they have, and the less tyranny they can wield over us. And I think the CPRB, I thought that was an excellent point, I think the CPRB is a great example of that. That there were eyewitnesses to almost every large case that came up in the last 2 years. How I got so jaded about the CPRB was that I actually was involved in the James Nay case. He was slammed by a police officer right in front of me at a city council meeting, and he had done nothing, basically body slammed and taken away for no reason. So I was an eyewitness. I gave a tape to the CPRB on what I had seen. Then they said, well, a tape isn't enough. You need to write it. So I sent a written form, and nothing was heard again. As far as I was concerned, the CPRB said later, well, when they called and interviewed you, I said, they who? The police. So the police never called me. Well, they say they did. So they didn't even follow up. When they had witnesses, they didn't follow up on their own to see if the police department had followed up. There was absolutely no accountability. So I think operating outside the sanctity of the city council and the appointed people would not be any more disastrous than it's been. And we wouldn't have to have people appointed by city council. We could actually have people who were really interested in following this up. Maybe some heroes even.
Yeah, it is true that if you don't have, I don't know whether it's a specific government body or an agreement with the police department, you don't get access to looking at the IA internal affairs files. But that doesn't matter if, for example, as Berkeley does, you have somebody else independent of the police department performing an independent investigation, or as you suggest, have a public hearing where the individuals who feel wronged bring their issue to a public discussion, and the police officers, if they want, can bring their side of the story in as well. The idea that what the Citizens Police Review Board has been doing is it has been looking completely and only, in almost all cases, at the reports of the police department, which sometimes calls up and interviews witnesses and sometimes doesn't. I was not interviewed by Sergeant McMahon on my complaint, for example, about the Norman Friedberg breadcrumb terrorist beating. That's a guy who was beaten, if I call it terrorist sarcastically, he was the furthest thing from a terrorist. He was a guy who threw breadcrumbs on the sidewalk to feed the birds last summer, and then because he wouldn't stay for a ticket, essentially got beaten, charged, pepper sprayed, handcuffed, dragged off to jail, held for a month and a half, and convicted. And the office CSO Gray and Sergeant Baker, who masterminded this absurdity, as far as I know, suffered no disciplinary consequences whatsoever. At least we don't know that they did. And the CPRB, which I requested hold a public hearing under Chair Half Moon, didn't even vote on the issue to hold a public hearing. There was no public hearing. There was no, he didn't vote for it. Nobody voted for it. And they essentially proceeded. Now, they proceeded, what they proceeded to do, to look at police reports. So there is another method that can be used, which is have individuals bring the testimony independently to a group of, well, you know, I don't want to say disinterested people in the community because I don't think that's quite fair. I think these would be advocates, and they would be a bias, I think, in favor of citizens. But I think there would also be some concern that there be fairness here. There's no point in a police review process that is false to the police.
The police work for the citizens.
Right. The police.
There should be a bias for the citizens. It's for the citizens' safety, for their protection.
Yeah.
And if they go overboard, which they do a lot here, Mark Half Moon spoke about how he really knew what police abuse was because he was from Philly. So don't, you know, he knows. We don't want it to get that way, Mark. We don't want it to get that way here. It is police abuse already here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been numerous instances of it this year, numerous violent incidences that I have either heard firsthand testimony about or seen complaints about that I think are sufficiently persuasive. One was a skateboarder slammed down across from New Leaf Market in an incident reported by Sherry Connable. I believe it was a skateboarder. Could have been a religious person. I'm not sure. It was a preacher. A second one was a man who had his teeth smashed on the sidewalk. Was done either by a sergeant, it's the sergeant who's not on at the same time as Baker, the other sergeant, McPhillips, or by the jovial, tall officer. And this is the claim of witnesses, and I don't say that it's necessarily true, but it was an allegation that seemed sufficiently serious for me to think that it should really be investigated independently. Then, of course, there was the Norman Friedberg case. We just talked about the breadcrumb beating of this guy. And then
witnesses go largely unnoticed. Can you please explain that? I still do not get that.
What do you mean?
It just seems like there's witnesses to all this, and what does the public think, that they're making it up? Or I don't understand, because a witness is just, it's like, yeah, that's what they say. That's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anybody who makes up a story against the police, as far as I'm concerned, would be a police target anyway. So why would you put yourself in that position? What is in it for you?
I hear you. I mean, it's also, in fact, another issue that's been brought up recently was mentioned in the paper that there were frivolous complaints. And one claim by San Jose Mercury News reporter was that I made the overwhelming majority of frivolous complaints that resulted in the demise of the board, according to a so-called inference by council member Mike Rotkin. Rotkin has not returned my calls to say that if he actually said that. He certainly didn't say it on the record. I know that, in terms of the city council meeting. But the reporter of the Mercury News claimed that he had said it privately to him. And I pointed out that I've made a total of 13 complaints throughout the 8 years on the Police Review Board. None of them have been frivolous. And if you make a false or frivolous complaint, that is a crime, per se. That is illegal to do. Unlike a complaint against any other kind of employee in the city government or state government system, if you make a complaint against a police officer, it's a crime if it's a false complaint. False complaints against other officers are not crimes, against other employees, I should say. So your point is well taken, Roxanne. It is a serious matter to make a false complaint against a police officer, both under the law and also in practice. You know, you may well get harassment because of it. Of course, you may get harassment for a true complaint.
When I was living in the beach flats, there was a woman running the public community garden named Gia. And she had just gotten very tired of how the police handled themselves in the beach flats. And
Gia Grant?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she made a complaint. And she was harassed to the point of having the police accuse her of having an open container in the garden. She actually left our community. She was 21 years old at the time. And what she said to me was, you know, I've never been in trouble in my life. I spoke up for something I believe in, and now they're going to make my life miserable every day that I'm here and find a way to either arrest me or do something against me to discredit the testimony that I gave to the CPRB about them.
It's not just the testimony. Gia Grant was a member of the CPRB. She was on the CPRB.
Because of what she had seen, right?
Probably because a city council member appointed her.
Oh, and then she didn't do what they wanted her to.
Well,
is that it?
Well, no, the point is that she apparently did things the police department didn't want her to do, and so they discredited and harassed her as a member of the CPRB and drove her off the board. They did something similar to John Malkin. Several members of the board. And Dan Alper also resigned from the board, though I don't think he did so because he felt driven off the board by police. The question, though, is where do we go from here? I mean, Christopher Crone yesterday on KSCO said what we should do is all show up at the Tuesday City Council meeting and tell the board don't abolish the CPRB, though it looks like they already have, although I guess they could refuse to pass the second reading of the law. I think that's highly unlikely, but, you know, I think it's certainly worth standing up and talking about the truth about this issue, as you pointed out, Roxanne. But the real issue is there a group of people who want to...
What's Christopher Crone's position on this? Is he becoming a good guy now that he's...
Is there people who want to, I'll answer that in a second, draw things together to do some alternate police review, some cop watch, some people's tribunal work, if you will? And the answer to what your question, Roxanne, is that as far as I know from what he said yesterday, now has a weekly show on KSCO. Every Wednesday he's on at noon, or actually 12:15 to 1 o'clock on 1080 a.m. for those who are interested. And he had on two CPRB members, Brent Faust and Mark Halfmoon, chair and vice chair. He had on Sandy Brown, previously a board member. He had on John Malkin, previously a board member. And he had, I guess, Michelle Samoa? Not sure what her name is. She's an attorney and now works with the OCC, the Office of Citizen Complaints, the Citizen Police Review Board in San Francisco. And she, I think, was instrumental in trying to start the CPRB here in Santa Cruz, back with the old Commission for Citizens Police Review, Coalition for a Citizens Police Review Commission. His position seems to be they moved in awfully fast to cut it off. It's not good. We need citizen police review. We need to have it real soon. Everybody needs to call in and tell the city council we need it. We need to show up at the meetings and say more police review. And in fact, he signed a letter at the last city council meeting that was presented that kind of deplored the end of police review and said, the Citizen Police Review Board needs to be part of the process. We urge you not to, back away from this thing. But he didn't ask for a stronger police review process that I'm aware of. He didn't, and particularly when he was mayor, and that was for the last year, take any action other than perhaps appointing Chair Halfmoon to strengthen the police review board. And to do something like call for independent investigations or call for public hearings or say, what the hell, what's the display of force policy? Why has the police chief been stonewalling on this for a year so that, you know, they can police officers can pull their guns? And that fact doesn't even have to be mentioned in a report unless an arrest is made. There's been the racial profiling issue has been buried. The selective enforcement issue has been buried. The latest shooting, the Raymond Quentin shooting, has been delayed for a year and a half. There's a whole bunch of other things, which if people are interested, I encourage you to go to www.santacruz.indymedia.org. Again, indymedia.org. And there's a really kind of a very certainly a lot of information on the website about this killing of the police review board. But, you know, your question is important, Roxanne. I mean, Christopher Crone is a part of the SCAN gang, and he introduces himself as a proud member of SCAN, the Santa Cruz Action Network. This is a group that, you know, I have been extremely critical of for ramming through the Dolphin Lee boondoggle, the thing that drove the majority of Latino families who used to live in the Dolphin Lee and Rexcourt apartments out of town, while claiming to create more affordable housing in the beach flats, this Fitzmaurice Byers project. And this was sort of masterminded by Bernice Belton and Nora Hockman, who, destroyed the housing committee that was looking into this, sidelined the sleeping ban activity that... SCAN has voted a lot of good positions. They voted to support the rights of the Dolphin Lee tenants and then abandoned them in the internal subcommittee steering committee process. While the membership said support and the sleeping ban, support the rights of Dolphin Lee tenants, support police review, the SCAN steering committee has been anything but supportive, although it has to be said, SCAN members Hockman and Bob Guzley and others, Pete Shanks and so forth, did stand up and oppose the downtown ordinances, sort of at the last minute, I might add, but they did oppose them. And they also, at this very last meeting, some of them signed this letter with Christopher Crone saying, please, oh, please, don't get rid of the police review board, or if you do, let's have them part of the process. It was a pretty weak-kneed letter. And I guess it's hard for me to see Christopher Crone as a fighting radical. I'd like to see that. I mean, I think maybe he's thrown off the chains of his city council, and now he's rolling ahead. But
when he became mayor, he actually did stick up for a couple things before he went out in a cloud of whatever it was. You know, he
medical marijuana smoke for
yeah,
the few.
Medical marijuana. He, you know, he did stick up for a couple things. I got the feeling maybe he was really tired of being laughed at by the rest of us. But it certainly was too little too late, and he's not a mover and a shaker. I have a funny feeling it's probably pretty hard for him to live in this community right now with so many people disenchanted with him that worked for him. At every city council meeting, people get up and say, I'm so sorry, I voted for you. I remember when Christopher Crone, the night that they were elected, the Herb Room supported, on their sign that they always have on Mission Street, they put that they supported Keith Sugar and Tim Fitzmaurice. But they left off Christopher's name. And it turned out to be somewhat prophetic. Not that they should have supported the other two either. But it kind of turned out to be a funny thing. And his, I mean, he just was crushed that night. That, you know, he was left out. Many people were on the fence about Christopher. And so I imagine he's spending some time trying to redeem himself. Maybe he'll get the Nobel Peace Prize like...
Henry Kissinger?
No, like Jimmy Carter just did. Mm-hmm. Carter has spent most of his life making up for his presidency. You know, so maybe it could be a good thing. Maybe he's humiliated enough that he actually might do something with his life.
Perhaps, although he didn't seem too pleased to hear me when I came on the air, and he didn't address the issue of... He didn't take any responsibility for 4 years of inaction, for 4 years of watching things get worse on city council and not speaking out about them. While it is true for...
That's shocking.
Yeah, what's that?
That he wouldn't admit it, or... That is shocking.
Well...
He's such an honest person.
Yes. Well, what I'm saying is, if he's going to be going through some kind of a conversion, I need to see him taking responsibility for what he did and not simply pretending like, you know, he's been a great fighter for progressive causes all along, and here he is continuing with that fight. He has to essentially, you know, describe reality as it's been and come clean. And that hasn't happened yet.
My sense is that Christopher's very proud of the banal things that he accomplished, that the city council accomplished. I think they named 14 things that they think are, like, tray important. And, you know, they've skirted every real social issue. They've done everything feel good they can think of. They've given us a teen center, you know, anything that would bring a couple of rah-rahs. They've medical marijuana, proclamations about every other city and state and federal problem there is, but without addressing the same problems exist as when they came in, the very same problems.
Well, and they produce legislation that has made it worse, and that in essence has tightened the police grip in terms of the powers that police have to harass poor and homeless people.
Well, that's because they really were Nazis in disguise. They actually were really, control freaks. And they, when they saw that people weren't going to accept their wishy-washy excuses, then they just started taking matters into their own hands because no one was going to talk back to them.
It's true. The city council did become repeatedly more progressive, and Crone cut back oral communication time as much as, if not more than, Fitzmaurice did. And indeed, he had me arrested at city council for the first time ever. I was actually taken into custody on orders of Mayor Christopher Crone for that fleeting silent gesture when I was essentially protesting Crone's cutoff of the speaking time of Susan Zeman. Sounds like we have a caller. Let's see if we can see what is cooking. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Is this the show that launched 1,000 Nazi salutes?
Some would say so, yes.
There's an echo in the background.
There is an echo. The echo is because we are trying to hear you at the same time as you're speaking. But go ahead.
I have to talk over the echo, and it's not that easy. But my comment, quite briefly, Mr. Norris and guests, which I think is Roseanne.
Roxanne. Mm-hmm.
Look like Roseanne.
Okay. What on earth did you expect? I think it was quite clear from the beginning what the realities were. And I think that all things considered, that including Mr. Crone, that he did an excellent job given his platform.
You want to take that one, Roxanne? This is.
Thank you for calling. What did I expect? I guess I was pretty naive. I actually, because I had been involved in the Beach Flats group, and they both had joined Keith Sugar and Christopher. And the people that they presented themselves as, which were just like gung-ho, movers, shakers, changers, supporters, I wasn't alone, but I think we really thought, finally we have someone that really will work for the underprivileged and change things around. You know, we'd had Mike Rotkin, who's like a mouth with tennis shoes, and I was hopeful, but I was hopeful, you know, when Clinton was president, too. I've kind of been zinged a couple times. I don't really work on campaigns anymore, but you can laugh at me if you want, but, you know, I really thought these guys really meant what they said.
Well, let me respond to you, if I might. First of all, with Clinton. Clinton, by the way, if you can recall, attempted to launch national health care.
The problem was that he lost so much respect among his own supporters, among the Democrats, and, of course, the Republicans never liked him anyway, that now we have Bush.
Well, Clinton,
that's the real problem.
Clinton floated serious trial balloons, and he found out that it just simply wasn't going to happen. You cannot fault the guy for making very sincere attempts. No, in my opinion, in regards to Mr. Sugar and Mr. Crone, I don't think from the get-go that there was, from my outlook, any expectation that they were going to be flaming radicals. I'd never heard of either one of them until they were floated as the prima donnas of the progressive slate for Santa Cruz.
But we had heard of them. We had worked with them. So we did have some feeling about them where you may not have.
Well, that may well be more privy than what I am, but in my opinion, I think that both gentlemen tried their best. They were grounded from their perspectives, and they were not going to tear up the street. I think very much like Clinton, they made some inroads that I might not even agree with in some cases, and they backed off because they felt like they were going to lose their main support base. Can't fault them.
They lost their main support base. They lost the people that put them in office. They took on a whole new support base, which was the George Owls and all the redevelopment people. They weren't afraid of losing us. We got them in, but we were all poor, and we were all, you know, radical. They picked up a whole new support base.
You know, what's wrong with George Owl and the redevelopment base?
The builders and redevelopment? Well, yeah. You know, when it comes to who they're going to fight for, if they're going to bow to money all the time, then they really were no different than anyone else.
No. Do you ever bow to money, Roxanne?
Not usually, but I'm not very smart.
Okay, so
I stay poor.
I mean, somebody picks up the tab at some point, Roxanne. And if we nix and diff everybody that comes in with a economic opportunity, then we're going to be left out.
I can think of a specific right now. You know, do you remember the car lot incident? The man that had the car rental place and the Nickelodeon, I think, was George Owen on that deal? Yeah, they were going to take the movie house and turn it into something spectacular. This guy basically lost his livelihood, his business. He had to relocate his business, whatever. One little guy who had a parking lot next to this theater, and then they all dumped.
No, you got it wrong.
No, let me finish, and then you can correct me. Just let me finish.
Go ahead.
When they decided to dump movie and go on to the Rio or the Del Mar, whichever one was their baby at the time, you know, they took, I mean, one guy just totally lost out on their whim. So, I mean, don't act like, oh, well, gee, they do such good things. And
I didn't say that, dear Roxanne. Forgive me for being a little bit flippant. But now, what was movie is going to be the Santa Cruz Community Credit Union.
So what?
You do know that, don't you?
They took a parking lot that they didn't need. There was so much parking there at night. I used to eat all the time at the old Pontiac Grill. That those parking lots were empty every night, and they supposedly needed his lot.
Maybe they did, and the lot he was leasing from whoever, and they called him on his lease. tough break, okay? We're living in a community that is on the coast.
You know, but caller, it's not. That's not the only example. They sold out Dolphin Leaf Families, Sugar lied about that whole issue.
Sold out Dolphin Leaf Families. I'm not sure whether I agree with that statement.
Did you go to the meetings? Did you go down?
No, I didn't go to the meetings.
Okay, you were at every meeting.
I'll tell you something. We're living in a community that is on the coast.
All I know, caller, is that Sugar lied to the people about this issue. And he admitted to Scott Graham he was lying about this issue. They lied in saying that everybody who was ousted from these apartments would get into the new apartments. And he lied about it. He was the mayor, and he lied. He was the mayor, and he smeared them as dirty,
go back where you came
from. If you want to live in those squalid conditions, you can go back where you came from. And Scam, to its credit, said, this is bullshit. We want these people to have all the guarantees that before you turn them out of their housing now, make sure they get the housing that you're claiming they're going to get. And Sugar and Crone wishy-washy lied about it. Sugar outright lied about it, but Crone ended up going along with the program.
I
don't think we should really spend a lot of time on this. This is sort of history.
Wait, I just want to say one thing to the caller. I know that Robert and I are really outspoken. And I know that you disagree with us, but please give us this credit, because we have taken so much time out of our lives. We went to every meeting down in the beach flats, the meetings in the trailer, in the market, in people's homes. We went to meetings at Western Service Workers with the tenants. I was a member of the neighborhood then. I actually lived right in the neighborhood when this was going on, so I definitely had my ear to the ground. There are things that we do know about. You can disagree and say, I don't really believe that, but you don't have any basis not to believe it. You weren't there.
I have the basis to believe that the elected city officials are paid $1,000 a month. The mayor is paid $2,000 a month. They put in at least 20, if not...
They don't have... Why do you think they do it?
Let me get my 30 seconds in between.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And then I'll pass on.
I'm sorry.
They put in 20 to 40 hours a week for essentially a volunteer job. For the most part, they do excellent work. I'm astounded at the level of credibility and integrity and intelligence that is elected in Santa Cruz. I don't agree with them across the board, but
that's hogwash,
I do think that we're essentially blessed with some very high integrity public officials. I think Emily Riley is an outstanding individual. I think Ed Porter is outstanding.
Is this a crank call?
No, it's not. I think that
are you sure?
Is outstanding. I think that we're very lucky. We're talking about $1,000 a month.
Why do you think they keep wanting to get reelected?
Because they enjoy the throughput, they enjoy the limelight, they enjoy the credibility.
This is all fluff, man. You've got no substance, Bob. There's no substance in anything you're saying.
I think this is a joke.
Where's the beef? You know, where's the beef?
Condemn them for taking positions on issues.
What have they done that is substantial? Where is their integrity?
That are very
show me, please.
And as far as I'm concerned, this whole thing about the Dolphin Lee and propping up blighted buildings, I think, Robert, is crackpot that takes away from your credibility.
You know what? I was waiting for you to say that because I can see that is really why you're calling.
Well,
I can see you don't really want to know the truth about anything. You just want to have your say and just come from this emotional point of view. But the truth is, you know, we have always said for years, those of us that lived in the beach flats for any amount of time, that if those houses, those same rundown houses, would have been full of tow-headed surfers and little surf buggies, even though they were falling down, everybody would have gone, how quaint, how cute. It was a big racial issue. It was a lot of things. And I don't think they're things that you're willing to look at. But I bet you haven't lived there. And I bet you haven't gone to the meetings. And you think we're crackpots.
No, I
stand in line.
I don't think you're a crackpot. I will listen to other callers, and thank you for letting me call.
Thank you, caller.
Thanks for the joke call.
And I do appreciate Bob's calling in.
Do we know him?
Yeah.
Bob who?
Bob is a man who's done rent control work. He's fought to have rent control in Santa
Cruz. Stand-up comedian.
And, you know, I mean, I've got to say I don't agree with what he said tonight. I mean, he likes to give a lot of credit to people in public office. I don't think that's a good idea. I think what you need to do is hold people's feet to the fire. But I think Bob also recognizes that, too. But whatever the situation is, We were originally talking about police review. I wasn't even trying to, you know, assess.
You know, this stuff is all related.
It is.
Even though it may seem like we're getting off the subject, we're really not.
Well, here's, let's see if somebody can,
another
can draw
joke
us even
caller.
Further on the. Hi, you're on free radio. Hello?
Yeah, I want to start with one thing. I think you got it wrong that Clinton wasn't the reason Bush won. I thought it was Nader.
Uh-huh. We won't even get into that one.
Oh. Well, anyway, I'd like to know, though, you know, I respect you guys' opinion, and but I think you might be coming down a little bit hard on the CPRB because, I've known Mark Hasselman for 20-some years. And,
now,
he's a sincere guy, you know, and he's been struggling to make that thing work.
This isn't anything personal. I hope you understand that.
Yeah, I like Mark.
We
personally.
Like Mark.
Mark's a nice guy.
You make some good points, too, that's for sure. But, you know, I think you might be missing a couple of points, too. That
what are we missing?
He just happens to be a black man in this community, which is not a real easy thing to be in the first place.
Yeah.
And he's trying to make a living at the same time. You
that's
know,
true.
The guy doesn't have a car half the time. And,
that's true.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's not as easy as everybody says it is.
No, but why should he spend his time on the police review board and do essentially very, very little and essentially raise people's expectations but not get anywhere?
Right, but you know, Robert, you've talked to him enough times about this, too. I mean, he's gone back to, you know, Boston and all that stuff to do the research to find out how the...
Every single police review board chair since this began takes that junket back to Boston. It's no big deal. In fact, it's a nice little trip.
But,
so what?
Well, but the other thing, you know, he's been spending 20 hours a minimum every week just trying to review things.
It doesn't mean anything unless you have public hearings. It doesn't mean anything unless you have the whole press conference.
Give the CPRB some teeth. You know, he wasn't out there just saying, oh, we just want this.
He didn't try to give the CPRB teeth in any meaningful time frame. And we told him that this fall, that the board was likely to go down, that he had to move quickly. He didn't do that. Instead, he moved at a snail's pace. And part of it was not because he intended to be, you know, to throw things in the way.
Let me ask you this, then.
Yeah.
How would you have dealt with it differently if you were there? And, you know, knowing that the constraints you're under and that you do have to please the council in some way or form.
You don't have to please the council.
Well, they would have killed you a long
time
ago.
No, you don't have to please the council. You have to educate the community. That's the first mistake if you think you have to please the council. Because if you think you have to please the council, you will never go anywhere.
No,
you have to take your charge seriously.
Four choice of words. Maybe it's not exactly please the council, but you do have to work in certain parameters that they outlay for you while you're trying to change them. I mean, you know, just trying to change things from within has got some validity. I know you have to change things from without too. I mean, I try to do it from both sides, you know, and neither one of them are easy.
You didn't use the tools within. I mean,
it's fucked up because of a lot of things that are going on in society.
The answer,
it's hard to fight. You know?
Yeah, the answer to your question, caller, is what would I do? You know, well, the first thing I would do is I would start holding public hearings, as I suggested to him the day he came on the board. Yet throughout his tenure, not once in his 12 months on the board did he ever vote for a public hearing. Why? He'll tell you, because he wanted to get a sort of an ironclad case, a case that he could be sure would be something that people couldn't scoff at. But in fact, what he ended up with was nothing. And now, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't necessarily, I'm not even questioning his judgment. It's this sort of conservative temperament that upsets me. And Mark is a mixed bag. I don't think he's just, you know, one of these scam liberals that is prepared to, you know, like protest twice a year and then spend the rest of the time trying to get people elected.
No, I don't believe that either.
What?
No, I don't believe that either.
No, I don't either. But I think that there was a fatal error. There are a couple of fatal errors. But my point is not really to second guess Mark. My question is, where do we go from here?
Well,
and where should we go from here?
I want to know, too, because, you know, I mean, this is one of the reasons why we have all these Nazis in control right now is because, you know, one reason, there's lots of reasons, but one reason is because, you know, we on the so-called left do so much infighting, you know, because there's so many issues that we have to address that are so important that we haven't really gotten it down to figure out how we're actually going to address them together.
Speaking
you know,
of which, Roxanne is kicking me in the groin
you know
and wants to say
they,
something.
They just figure, you know, fuck everybody and pay all our friends and the hell with everybody else. So they're...
Was it Saturday?
Sunday. And it was that, Robert, I believe that they don't do anything for the homeless just because they don't like you. I think that was the gist of it. And, you know...
Well, hey, no, a lot of people don't like Robert, but
well,
that's another story.
Really? Me included. No, but this is what I want to say, is that I've heard that remark so many times. I'm pretty vocal, and people say, well, people just don't want to do anything for you because you don't work in the system, or you just talk out. You don't temper your remarks. But, you know, the truth is, and I think that most people will agree, if you were going to do something right...
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to do something right by the beach flats people or right by the homeless, would you let somebody you didn't like who was for the same thing keep you from doing it? You wouldn't. You would do the right thing. And so that's always been an excuse of city council. Well, we were going to do it.
Well,
but then,
sure, that's a weak excuse.
But Mark bought into that. He bought into it. Hook, line, and sinker, which tells me that he's not the right person to be doing this. He doesn't understand that, of course, these kinds of things are used as excuses for taking no action or for backpedaling. I've heard people, what's Bernice Belton say the same thing, that Robert has just ruined everything for the homeless. Just when city council was ready to do something good, Robert ruined it by something he said.
That's just her lame excuse. You know?
But when
a lot of people use it. I mean, a lot of people are looking for excuses. Well,
Mark thinks that if he's not that kind of a person, that he's going to be effective. And he's not going to be effective. I mean,
I think you're kind of painting him with a broad brush.
Well, I'm not saying that to be mean. I'm just saying that he's got to have more backbone, and he's got to, he has to do the right thing, whether it's uncomfortable or not. He has to demand the reports. He has to know what is the timeline for an investigation. What can we expect out of this, and keep following up? I don't really believe that there was anything in his guidelines that kept him from doing that. They didn't want to tick anyone off. We all started out that way. Do you think, I mean, it's not fun ticking people off.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually very, very uncomfortable. And sometimes you just, no matter how scared you are, you know it's the right thing.
Well, but, you know, I think another part of it is, too, we look at the fact that we're all pretty much up against the wall now, too. I mean, I started off as a kind of a mellow guy, too, you know. And now I'm just like, I'm fucking pissed off because everybody's hammering on us all, you know. And I'm sick of it, and that, you know, that's why I've become, you know, the radical that I am these days. And I have a long ways to go before I feel like I'm going to be effective.
Yeah, more local section in the Green Press, please. Ron.
Well, you know,
local news. Thank you.
We're doing what we can.
I understand.
You know? I mean, and that's another story. Well, you'll probably hate the next issue because I'm not going to be part of it at all, and it's a whole
bummer.
You know, national kind of a trip. But
right. Well, I'm glad that you're putting out that Green Press in the middle of the comic news, and I'm glad that you raised these issues. And frankly, I mean, the first good news I heard all day was that Mark maybe intended to actually throw a meeting on Sunday and get the CPRB in exile going instead of just sort of showing up on talk shows and talking about maybe having it happen. I get worried when people backpedal, but you know, it's going to be a hard job to have an independent police review board. It's going to require a lot of work, and indeed, Mark doesn't have a lot of time. He's a hard-working guy. He's struggling, but there seems to me to be there's enough resources in the community to do this if we all get together.
That's the big thing right there. You know, this might be the push that we all needed to get everybody involved. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who have been naysaying the CPRB. And a lot of people who just kind of sat on their thumbs and really had no opinion one way or the other. But now that it's come to the, you know, push to shove, you know, maybe these meetings in exile will actually bring a couple of more people out.
If we can have a meeting, I would love to do it. And maybe we can get, maybe Mark or you or someone will announce we're going to throw this meeting and go for the gusto. And I invite the next caller to call for a meeting, and let's all go to it and do it.
Yeah,
the word I heard the most in that call used by Mark was try. We tried to do this. We're going to try. Well, we'll try. Now, we haven't done anything yet, but we're going to try. Try is not an action word. Just anytime you listen to somebody who uses the word but or try all the time, they're not committed yet. They just aren't. You either do something or you don't do it. You don't try.
Let me move on, Ray, because we got two other guests in the studio who have not had a chance to even get to the mic, and I'm going to have to start rolling their way.
Well, let's all shut up and let them talk then.
Why not?
All righty.
Hey, yeah. Thanks. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM, and I'm going to play a little bit of Phil Oakes, and then we're going to move on to our second guest, Roxanne. Anything you want to conclude with? I appreciate you being in the studio with us.
No, I just want to say goodbye, and I want to tell Mark that, Mark, personally, I'm not against you at all, but you got to get some guts, and you can. Robert will show you how to do it. And we got to get things under control here locally. I mean, the national scene is bad enough with the bullies the way they are. We don't need them locally. We really need people who are committed, not just because they're black, not just because, but for everyone. Everyone's at risk when the police are out of control.
And I know that we all know that. Thank you, Roxanne, and thank you for being with us. You're tuned to 96.3 FM. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're talking about the death of the Citizens Police Review Board and some of the controversy that has followed that dismemberment, which I suppose isn't officially finished until the City Council comes back on Tuesday and votes for a second reading of the end of the CPRB, although actually the office has been closed, interestingly enough. We also have in the studio with us here a man who's had some interesting experiences with the city manager's office and the police. He's struggling with papers all over the floor. I got to tell you, this guy has more papers than I do, which is saying quite something. I thought I was the man with the papers. Sir, will you please sign in? Who are we talking to?
This is John Golder.
And John, speak up a little bit.
This is John Golder.
Gotcha. And John, you live in your vehicle.
At the moment, yeah.
And you, I guess you, how long have you been in Santa Cruz?
I've been back in town since July.
And you've kind of come and gone. You've been a Santa Cruz resident different times? Or?
Yes, I lived in Santa Cruz for 15 years, from 78 to 93. Worked for the city for 6 years in the planning department as a building inspector. And raised family here. That my sons still live in town. I have lots of connections, lots of friends still in town.
And you came back, and I guess you had a particular interest in something about the master plan for the Poganip. Am I right on that one?
Well,
Greenbelt
situation. Yeah, I came back to town, and I was waiting for some wages that were owed me from a survey, biological survey I did in the spring. And I had, at the time, the last few years before I left Santa Cruz, which was early 90s, I'd been involved with the Greenbelt. I was on the Greenbelt Committee. I worked very hard to try and get some more sports fields for city sports teams in Poganip. That didn't work out, but I did wind up on the Greenbelt Committee, and we did a lot of work to decide what the priorities for Greenbelt management and purchase were going to be. And so I decided, while I was waiting for my wages, to take a good long look at what had happened in the first 10 years of Greenbelt management of the city, and see whether the promises and the priorities that we had established on that committee, which were the result of almost 3 years, I believe, of public input process, had been carried out.
And what did you find?
Well, I found that they essentially had been put under a shelf, it looks like. I was very open about my investigation. I tried to kind of get on the inside by being a volunteer for the Parks and Recreation Department. I was mysteriously shut off from that opportunity, even though the Parks and Recreation Department had plenty of open positions and underfunded positions. But the more I started looking into the problem, the more resistance I seemed to run into from Parks and Recreation Department.
Mm-hmm. And, again, you were simply trying to find out where were these sports fields that you've been looking to get, and what kind of resistance did you find?
Well, the main resistance I ran into was in the management of Parks and Recreation Department. The associate planner, Sue Harris, whose job it is, essentially they call her the Greenbelt Planner, is supposed to know just about everything there is to know about the Greenbelt Master Plan and it's her job to implement the plan, help implement it, and know the studies involved, and recommend what's going to happen next. As far as the actual constructive implementation of the plan, not to set policy, but to basically get the thing working.
And you were looking for information about where things were, and I guess you started to make Public Records Act requests?
I started to ask first informally, and then more formally. I was required to ask for things in writing, which I don't mind doing. I actually do it as a matter of habit. I spent a great deal of time working on both sides of the counter bureaucracies, and I find that given the volume of information that passes back and forth.
And did you begin to encounter resistance from your Public Records Act requests?
Absolutely. I would submit a request, and I would wait sometimes weeks to get any kind of response at all.
I think they asked you to do it in 2 weeks or 10 days, something like that.
The legal requirement is 10 days, I believe, when you make a request under. And there's a very important act, I think, for everybody who deals with government to know. It's called the California Public Records Act.
I've actually been using it to try to find out where the benches have gone from the downtown Pacific Avenue.
Yeah. It's a government code. It's in California statutes, government code 6250, 6251. Mm-hmm. It tells you exactly what items of information you're entitled to get, what's disclosable and what's not disclosable.
So you went up to the city manager's office to try to break through the logjam and find out what was going on?
Well, I was getting a lot of resistance, and then the event that really compounded things a great deal was in the middle of resistance I was getting on the Greenbelt investigation. I had a parking citation problem, and the city wound up booting my car. Actually, what happened is I was assisting some poor young man who his car had been booted and trying to help him understand the law and what to do, and before I knew it, the authorities were booting my car, and I was just outraged. I didn't know what was going on. I asked, "How can you do this? What's your justification?" And they sent me down to the parking control office, and I said, "Show me what you've got to authorize you to boot my car." And they printed out this little computer list with showed some old violations, some of which were about 5 years old, right at the limit, and a couple parking meter expirations, et cetera. And, we won't go into the whole story right now, but basically what happened, they wanted $753 to let my car out. Now, I was broke at the time. I was highly dependent on my vehicle. I had everything that I owned in there. I teach outdoor skills and live out of my car, so I was really totally dependent on my car. I certainly didn't have $753. I could not understand. I didn't think that what they had done was legal. I was pretty sure it wasn't legal. So I prayed real hard, and lo and behold, the boot was gone the next day.
Really? How did that happen?
Well, it takes a lot of faith, Robert.
Well, what's the complaint? Last I heard from you, they put you in jail for a month, and they were trying to get an injunction against you at City Hall. How did we get from successful prayers to pariah of the town?
Well, again, for 3 weeks I avoided parking on city streets, but I went downtown and parked for about 15 minutes right opposite the parking control office, and came back, and my car was booted again. And I was pretty outraged. I was sure that it was not legal, and I was legally parked at the time. I went over parking control and told them not to make a mistake and to please take the boot off. And they responded by calling a tow truck. I responded by getting back in the vehicle and refusing to get out. So they sent a couple of cops over to me, and I really didn't have much to say to them. And so they sent a couple more cops over. A crowd started to gather. There was about, I don't know, at least six or eight people from parking control and four cops and a crowd of onlookers. And the police said that I was obstructing an officer. And I said, what you're trying to do is seize my property without due process. And I refused to leave the vehicle. And I essentially told them they'd have to mace me and burn me out. So I said, though, I will negotiate with you. If you will arrange a reasonable amount of bond with parking control, and I'll pay the bond and we'll settle this in court, because none of these parking citations have been proven. They were all alleged. And parking control refused to negotiate. Sergeant Sanders was the fellow who carried the information back and forth, and they refused to negotiate. So he decided he was going to go ahead and storm my vehicle, which he proceeded to start to do. My rear window was broken, so he started pitching my belongings in the street. And I have a dog, which I love dearly. I rescued him about 6 months ago, and he's just become a very important part of my life. And Sergeant Sanders threatened to shoot my dog. And I thought to myself, in the middle of all this, there's a crowd of onlookers. We're right downtown. There's people all around. These are parking tickets, the least of all public violations, and less serious than littering. And I thought to myself, am I the only sane person left here? I'm being stormed by four cops. This is what they're going to do for a parking ticket? So I said, wait a minute, let's negotiate again. And I said, look, I'll surrender the vehicle if you promise not to arrest me, not to touch my dog, and give me all the time I need to get my belongings out. That's what happened. The police kept their promise, and so the police got my car. Towed it off. North County Towing towed it off. And I went straight to a friend of mine and then straight to the law library and spent about a week and a half researching all the laws involved. I found that the city was in violation of at least a half a dozen state statutes in the vehicle code regarding the way they handle parking tickets.
For example?
Well, for example, if they want to immobilize your vehicle, or that means boot it or tow it, if you ask them for copies of the tickets, they have to deliver to you a complete photostatic copy or a complete abstract of every bit of information on that ticket, on every one of those tickets that they're using to verify or to authorize the tow or impoundment. They have to have five or more tickets that are over 21 days where they haven't been responded to. So if they don't give that to you, they're not allowed under the law. And I'm going to grab the section here in a minute. They're not allowed to immobilize or impound you, but they just they go ahead with it right away. So that's an important statute to know. That the other thing is that if you can't afford to pay the ticket, and they insist that you pay the ticket before they'll take the boot off or release your car, every single agency that issues tickets is supposed to have a written alternative program for people who really can't afford to pay, and a whole process, and they're supposed to tell you about that when they give you the ticket or the impoundment order, but they totally ignore that one.
Do you have those code sections available so people who are skeptical and think that I'm dealing with some kind of nutcase here in the studio can...
Absolutely, Robert. So if you'll fill the...
I'll fill the gap while you dash back to pick up the appropriate statutes. We're talking to John Goldern. Is that correct, John?
Yes.
John is a man who I ran into in a Chinese restaurant after a city council meeting, who informed me that he apparently had so enraged city manager Dick Wilson that Dick was going to get an injunction against him, not just for himself, but for all city employees. And I think that process is still going on. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot more to this story, but let me give you these sections. These are really important sections to know. California Vehicle Code 40206.5A. That's 40206.5A in the vehicle code. And you can go down to the Motor Vehicle Department and get a complete copy of the code for $3. It's a great doorstop. It's huge. It's a good buy for
$3.
$3, you've got enough toilet paper there for at least a month.
And this is the code section that says you got to have at least verified records of five tickets?
No, this is the section that says...
alternate service required?
That if you demand... copies of the parking tickets,
right.
They have to provide them to you before they can do any booting or immobilization, so or any towing. Now, Section 40215A is the statute that explains exactly how issuing and processing is supposed to happen. And issuing agencies and processing agencies in Santa Cruz are the same thing. It's parking control. In some cases, the police are involved, but most of the time it's the parking control. If you can't pay under 40215B, if you can't pay the penalty before the hearing that you're supposed to be able to get, the issuing agency has to provide a written procedure to allow a person to have a hearing without paying first. And the city totally ignores that requirement. They don't make any mention of it. They never bring it up. Now, I after my car was towed, I insisted on a hearing. And you're allowed to demand to be taken immediately before a hearing. And so I called up the city attorney. If you ask for it in writing, they can actually charge you for it. The law is kind of ambiguous. But so I asked for it on the phone. And city attorney said, yeah, fine. You know, we'll grant you a hearing. I get down there and waiting for my hearing. And Officer Black shows up. He's the fellow who gives these post-storage hearings. And he demanded an $85 fee for it. And I showed him the law where it says you are not required to pay. You do not have to pay to get this hearing. And he looks at me, I look at him, and I said, well, call the city attorney. So he called the city attorney, and Assistant Attorney Condotti told him just treat it like any other case. And so he denied me the hearing, and I insisted that he write that down. So I was denied the hearing. That's called due process. That's what's our constitutional guarantee that if there's a seizure of any sort, and what this technically is called is under the law would be a prejudgmental seizure of personality, or personality meaning personal goods. There's been no judgment. There's been no court decision. Nothing's been actually determined by a court of law, and yet they've seized your property.
Wait a minute, John. Maybe you are an enemy combatant and actually are not entitled to these rights. Could that be the reason that you're being...
I think that we did most of our combating back in the... it started about 1775 and for about 8 years, and finally at Saratoga we won the right to be our own government and to...
Well, we know these things happen in Washington, but not in Santa Cruz. Certainly you must be wrong. Not from our police department and our city attorney.
Well, it's I'll tell you what was really ironic is to see the all the hoopla about the city's concern over the seizures of the marijuana farm up on the coast. And then I've been the focal point of now seven unlawful seizures by the city.
And what were the other six? You mentioned this vehicle.
Well, my vehicle got booted twice and impounded once, and then I was arrested twice. The second arrest, I think, is what we'll talk about. And then my family gave the city $1,483 to get my car back, and didn't get my car back.
Yeah, but think of the good times you probably gave certain city officials with that money. You were really helping the budget crisis.
I guess I was.
Yeah, I mean, that's a sort of a positive thing. So anyway, so you were arrested twice?
Yes, well, needless to say, my Greenbelt investigation went on hold, and I spent all my time trying to find out how to get my car back, and I was working through a negotiator, a friend, and we worked through Councilman Porter, but... it took more than a month to get my car back.
And this was all happening in October and November?
This was October, early November. And then while the city had my car, I had a utility trailer. And the utility trailer was used it to store extra equipment and to help teach my outdoor skills classes. And I couldn't move it, so it got towed. And then I tried to find out what happened to my utility trailer. And the police absolutely refused to tell me anything. I went down to the police station and filled out a report. I couldn't remember the license number. They refused to respond to me at all. It turned out that the Arizona title transfer had never completed, transferred to my name for some reason or another. Nevertheless, I had plenty of things to prove that I was the owner of this trailer, and yet the police absolutely refused to give me any type of hearing at all. And in fact, I found out later on, under the law, that the city was supposed to send out a notice of hearing to the people who, it was my neighbor that I purchased it from, within 48 hours after the trader was towed. Now, that notice was never sent.
Well, but there's a budget crisis in the city. Perhaps they couldn't afford the stamps.
They had $1,483 to work with, Robert. That's bond held, not forfeited.
Well, yes, but at that time, the Citizens Police Review Board was using up valuable funds.
Well, actually, and part of it was being used on a report that I gave them that, to investigate why the city never produced a police report of the incident where they forced me by force of arms and authority out of my vehicle. Spent 2 hours, four cops, and there's no incident report, and they don't want to produce one.
After they were throwing your stuff in the street?
That's correct.
But are you talking about Sergeant Sanders?
Yeah, I'm talking about Sergeant Sanders.
Well, certainly the sergeant would never do such a thing without a good reason.
I guess his reason is that...
Luckily, he won't have to justify that before a Citizens Police Review Board, will he?
No.
Go ahead.
No. Well, as a result of all this activity on my part and the resistance on the city, some research requests that I was continuing to make from the city, including asking for the contract between City Attorney Barisoni and the city and a few other things that are kind of dear to the operation. And City Manager Richard Wilson came up to me while I was in City Hall and handed me a letter forbidding me to have any contact face-to-face with staff. He had gotten reports that I was simply too annoying or too threatening or too intimidating or whatever. Now, I'm the guy who got my car taken away from and was threatened with gunfire and walking for a month, et cetera.
You had a dangerous dog that they were offering to get rid of for you, and I don't see what your problem is. But in any case, you say Dick Wilson served you with a letter saying, don't you talk to any of my staff anymore. By which he meant any staff of any department in the city? Is that what he
exactly. The letter went out to every department in the city, and after that I could get nothing done. And this is a clear example. One of the things I was investigating because of this administrative review, I looked up the law, and it turns out that this administrative review of parking tickets, there's requirements in the state code for that. And so I'd had a lot of luck at human resources because having worked for the city, I knew how things worked, and I knew that I could find out exactly what people's jobs responsibilities were by going down to Human Resources and getting a copy of their job description. And Human Resources has always been very helpful in that. So I looked up, in fact, they'll even tell you who's filling the job. So I looked up who did administrative review, and it's Marlon Granlund, and he's a parking control supervisor. And so I looked up to see if he had the requirements, if he had the training. It didn't seem like he did, and it didn't seem like he met the requirements. So I went into Human Resources and wrote a one-page letter and asked them, does this man meet these requirements for doing administrative
review?
What
kind of requirements would they be?
Well, he's supposed to have at least 20 hours of training. He's not supposed to be connected at all with the parking enforcement and collection process. He's not supposed to be managed or employed by anybody who's directly involved in that. He's basically supposed to be a fair, independent reviewer. And it pretty much seems like he doesn't meet any of those requirements. But I couldn't find out what his training was without asking Human Resources. So I just asked him for simple yes or no on that and gave him a copy of the state statutes. And so I handed this letter to the secretary at Human Resources, and I said, well, will you please copy it for me? And I always do that. I always get a copy before I turn anything into the city. And she refused to do it. And I said, I can't believe you're refusing me. I said, I'll pay for it. They normally pay 10 cents a page. No, won't do it. So talk to your supervisor. Supervisor came. No, we won't do it. I said, well, why not? I mean, you give away hundreds of copies every day to people applying for jobs. So why won't you copy this one page? Well, they called the cops. And I was being firm that I wanted a copy, but I just left and went across to City Hall City Clerk's office to get the copy made because they've never refused me. And in the meanwhile, the city sent, was it Sergeant Lennon over, Sergeant Lonin over, and he came and confronted me outside City Hall and told me I was trespassing on city property, and handed me another copy of Dick Wilson's letter and said, if you don't leave, you know, you're going to be arrested for trespassing. You can't be on city property.
Well, that's right. The city property, as we know, belongs to the city manager, not to the citizens. I mean, that's been clear for some time.
Well, I stood there in front of Sergeant Lunn, and I said, well, if you say I can't be on city property, I said, does that include the street? Does that include the library? Does that, you know, well, what does that include? I mean, Dick Wilson's letter was kind of like an informal restraining order that was very unclear. When you talk about city facilities and city property and city employees, they're all over the city. So I could be in violation here and turn around the corner and meet a water meter reader, and I'd be in violation. If I nodded to a gardener on the mall, I'd be in violation. If I went to Loud Nelson Center to look at the bulletin board, I'd be in violation. So it's clearly very unfair, and I felt extremely not only discriminated against with my civil rights violated, but I still didn't have my trailer back and had no idea what happened to it, and I wasn't getting a response from the city.
To get along, you've got to go along, you know, or vice versa. So I think your problem here is you're not smiling enough. This is a very friendly administration. We have a mayor who's a baker, who's, you know, kind of, she's Emily's good things to eat. I think you have to take a more positive attitude. So Sergeant Lennon threatened to arrest you, and then what happened?
Well, I walked off the property, escorted off, that is, but I still wanted to get a copy of this letter back to Human Resources, so I just went over to the library, and I found somebody who looked like they were pretty hard up for bucks, and I handed it to him, and I said, well, here's a dollar. You just take this over and get it stamped and bring me a copy. And they did, and of course, when they took it over there, the secretary knew exactly who it came from, but you know, if they won't let me go over there personally, there's plenty of people around who'll run a little errand.
So, but what about your first arrest? I'm still waiting to hear the exciting moment. And by the way, we tried to condense this a little bit because we're running short on time, and we have guest number three who's going to get about 3.5 minutes, it looks like, at this rate. That's the inimitable Jeffrey Gale, who's going to rage at the mighty very, very briefly at the end of our show. But go ahead. We're talking with John Goldern and his adventures with the city manager. Go ahead.
Well, I went back to the city manager's office to try to get an appointment with him about the letter so that I could make some progress on this thing. I made the, I guess you would call it a tactical error of slipping my tomahawk into my belt. I was on my bike and on my bike trailer. I didn't want somebody to walk off with that. And somebody saw me do it. And they called the police. I was in the office, had a short conversation with Assistant City Manager Martin Bernal, and couldn't get an appointment. But and so I stepped out, and there were four cops waiting for me. They asked me if I had a hatchet. I surrendered it. And
had you chopped down the cherry tree in the back?
I hadn't done a thing with it. I was just tucked in my belt, and that's where I normally carry it. It's my tool of trade for an outdoor skills instructor. And then they were asking me, I had my tape recorder and my constitution in my hand, and they tried to wrestle that away from me, and there was a little bit of struggle until I was made sure the tape recorder was going. I had it going the entire time I was in the office. And then as I was standing there complying with the officer's requests, one of the officers twisted my arm, and what I recognize is the hold, the pre-handcuff hold, and I had already made up my mind I was not going to get arrested for doing nothing wrong, and I resisted. And the four of Santa Cruz's finest and I had about a two-minute workout there right in front of City Hall, during which time I kept yelling, am I under arrest, am I under arrest, and I, of course, didn't get an answer. Finally, they got a hold of one of my legs and forced me to give in.
Took you to the Hooskow, probably.
I was in the Hooskow for 35 days.
What were you charged with?
I was charged, they said that my tomahawk was a dirk or dagger under the California Deadly Weapons Act, and the judge threw that one out. They had nothing to support it.
Which judge?
Judge Tanner did.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing. Go ahead.
And so eventually the charges were dropped down to misdemeanors. They were still looking for something to
hang the resisting arrest charge.
Well, they were trying to make the arrest lawful, and because if the arrest isn't lawful, then my resistance is lawful under what I was charged with, so they hung on to the mace charge, and then there was a vandalism charge for kicking the police door,
but that happened afterward, right?
That was afterward, yeah. So eventually, it all boiled down to after they kept offering better and better plea bargains. They finally offered me a plea bargain that I just decided to take to avoid about a week and a half of trial.
What was the plea bargain you accepted?
Well, I pleaded guilty to vandalism, the lowest count of vandalism, and paid about $160 to the city.
Are you on probation?
And just got to obey the laws, Robert, you know, if that's possible.
Are you on probation?
Yeah, just informal probation.
Doesn't matter. Good. All right, but now they're also threatening you with a civil injunction.
By the way, is this lawful what I'm doing right now?
I'm afraid we have to take you away. Officer, over here. So you also, they were trying to get a civil injunction against you, correct?
Yeah, so they served me in jail with a petition for a permanent injunction. It's what that is like a permanent restraining order. And they want to keep me 50 yards from any city employee, any city facility, or field or administrative office. And that includes, again, you can imagine I couldn't ride the bus. You know, I couldn't use a city bathroom.
It's that a tomahawk. I think they're afraid of you and your little tomahawk, or possibly your vehicle.
Well, the judge gave me back the tomahawk today.
Today, really?
Well, yeah, they're letting me have it back in my tape recorder.
What about the civil injunction? Are you still proceeding?
I am fighting the civil injunction. Actually, I've got a hearing coming up, February 26th, evidentiary hearing, and anybody that's interested in this. As it is, it's a civil rights battle is what it is, really. Could come there February 26th, 9 o'clock, Department 5, Superior Court, unless it gets postponed, it may. These things get pretty complicated. I've got about a dozen subpoenas I'm getting ready to serve on the city.
You're not supposed to go near the city offices.
No, I got to send somebody else out.
So even though that they haven't really got the injunction, they've got some sort of ex parte injunction? Or?
Well, they have a temporary restraining order. I can contact the city in writing at this point, but I can't go down there and grab them by the lapel anymore.
Well, at least a menace to the city has been kept away from the city manager's office. We've been talking with that terrorist, John Goldern. John, we don't have much time because we've got to throw in guest number three. Are you going to be able to come back and talk to us again about this subject?
Yeah, I'd like to come back on Sunday and talk in more detail and also cover a lot more of this parking. I'd really like to hear from people who have had their cars towed, impounded. There's a lot we can do. There's a lot of law that is protecting us. If we get together and work on it.
If you had a problem with a vehicle, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I'll pass it on to John here, and or tune in next Sunday, in 4 days, actually. That's between 10 a.m. Actually, it's between 9:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. It's my new time. I'm not going to be going until 1:30. I'm only going to be going until 1 o'clock. The collective has lowered the hatchet on me. They've had just about enough of Norse and his blathering, I must say. And I can't really blame them. I mean, after all, who wants to listen to me for 3.5 hours? Actually, you'll be able to. You just have to tune in half an hour earlier, 9:30. John, thank you for being with us. I'm sorry to hustle you off. I want to give this other poor individual who's been standing quietly in the back, shifting from foot to foot. He actually was on KSCO. He hasn't merely been an adjunct to my ranting and raving here on this teeny tiny free radio station. He has made it into the big time. He actually was a talk show host at one time on radio station Michael's Whirling Rules, KSCO. Jeffrey, welcome back to Free Radio Santa Cruz. You have about 12 minutes to rant and rave. Start ranting.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. And, you know, all the wealthy folks in this area are down at Pebble Beach to watch the old Bing Crosby clam bake. A multimillionaire straight-A student from Stanford University named Tiger Woods had knee surgery for the first time in his life. So, of course, he couldn't tee it up today. So, Robert, I thought you might take his place. You know, you could be a rich guy by the end of Sunday.
Miniature golf has always been my forte, Jeffrey. Although I thought the golf courses would make excellent campgrounds for the homeless. Right?
Well, that's my dear partner, Apollonia Day from Hawaii. She has said over and over to me for the last 6 months that the reason that she really is upset at the golfing kingdom is that when you have 3,000 homeless people on the island of Maui and you have 8 million Americans who are